Hey, listeners, it's your host, Aisha. You're about to hear my chat with Galen Lee, who my NPR nerds out there will remember as the Tiny Desk Contest winner of a couple of years ago. I'm going to bet that Galen gets this a lot, but having her here was a really memorable experience. I was actually kind of nervous to talk to her because she's kind of a big deal, but she was so warm and easy to talk to that she immediately put me at ease. I could have spent the whole afternoon chatting with her, really. I kind of almost did. And she was really generous with her time because in addition to doing this show, she also recorded a video performance for our Skyline Sessions series. I'm going to put a link to those videos in the web article for this show, by the way. Anyhow, Galen Lee is touring all over the place right now as I speak, so if you get a chance to see her in your town, do it. And if you enjoy our little show, go on over to iTunes, subscribe to us, rate us, review us. Every time you do, a unicorn whinnies next to a rainbow. True story. Enjoy the episode. Do not include that. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement over here.
I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical music voice.
I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I am Daisha Clay, and here with me in the studio today is Galen Lee. She's a classically trained violinist. She won NPR's 2016 Tiny Desk Contest with her song, Someday We'll Linger in the Sun, an amazing song. She's also part of a duo with Alan Sparhawk from the band Low, one of my all-time favorites, called Murder of Crows. And she speaks publicly about disability, overcoming challenges, and the joy of music. Galen Lee, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Daisha.
So you just got done performing at South by Southwest. What was that like?
I had such a good time. And I wasn't sure if I was going to, because whenever I would say, like, I'm going to South by, everyone would just say the traffic is terrible and it's so busy. And that's, like, all I had coming in. But we went in with an open mind, and it was so fun. I did 6 shows, one official showcase and a bunch of unofficial ones. And just, like, walking around the streets was fun. I busked. I played my fiddle on the corner for a little while one day. And just, like, saw a lot of friends, surprisingly. Like, saw people I knew and got to see some cool music. And it was just really, really fun. And my friend Al Church, who is on my last 2 solo albums, he was like, I wish I could go. And I was like, I wish I could have you come, but we're on tour and I, you know, this South by is not like a big paying thing, right?
Yeah.
But he's like, well, I'll just fly down there. And so he came and he sat in with me on the last 4 shows.
Nice.
And so we got to do that together. And it was just like, it was really, really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I remember, speaking of the traffic, when I briefly lived in Austin, you know that you are a local when you leave the city and flee the festival.
Yeah.
You just try to get around it.
Yep.
Because it's so many people. I heard a story on NPR on Marketplace the other day where they were talking about how for South by, for the music portion, 150,000 people descend upon the city.
Yeah, I mean, it was really crowded for sure. But one thing that I thought was cool is there were quite a few locals who just went to the free shows.
Yeah,
and we got to meet them. So it was a good mix. I thought it was only going to be people from out of town.
Uh-huh.
But they only go to, I mean, like, the tickets are not cheap, but there's a lot of free stuff to do.
Yeah,
so I played
a bunch
of free showcases, which was fun because I wanted to make sure. I have never been there before, you know. Mm.
Yeah, and Austin's a great town. And yeah, you can actually do a whole, like, free South by Experience, which I've done, and it's so nice. You can just like walk into a club and see amazing music. There's just like music pouring out of every door. You know? It's super cool.
It was fun. I'm glad that we did that. It was pretty, I think it was worth it. It was really fun.
I want to talk about your journey as a musician. That sounds cheesy, but
no, I want
to talk about like you. So you're a classically trained violinist. How did you get into playing violin? Why did that become your instrument?
Well, when I was in fourth grade, the orchestra came to my elementary school. The junior high orchestra came down and played for us. And I just was really enamored with the sound of it. I just really liked it. And I knew that next year in fifth grade, we had a chance to join orchestra. So I just went home and told my parents, like, I'm going to be in orchestra next year. And they're not string players. They had no idea. And I am very small. I have a disability that makes my arms and legs really small. And so obviously it wasn't super obvious how that was going to work out, but they just said, okay. And so then the summer came and went, and the next year you had to take a music listening test to join orchestra, and I was the only one that got a perfect score. And I think that's why the teacher took a special interest in like helping me adapt my instrument. So we tried all sorts of things. I tried the cello. It was too big. And I tried playing the violin up on my shoulder the way you usually do, but that was too big. Even like a tiny violin was too long for my arms. But somehow we came across playing it up and down like a cello. So I play a violin up and down like a cello, and I hold my bow like a bass player. But it works. And then after that, it wasn't like a big deal. We just kind of learned alongside everybody else. I just play it from a different position.
Once you kind of like worked out the physicality of how to do it, you were just...
It's not like a thing I think about very much, because it's the way that you learn any instrument. It's all foreign to you anyways. But I'm grateful that she took the time to figure that out with me, because she could have easily just said, well, you should do choir.
Yeah.
And I probably would have, and never... This is such a different life path. I mean, it like really altered the path of my existence, so I'm grateful for it.
But you sing too. Speaking of choir, has that always been a part of your music? Or
I mean, my family is very musical. My parents owned a dinner theater since I was like 10, and
That's cool.
And they do a lot of musicals. They're retired from it now, but they did it for 20 years. And so music was definitely a part. Like, I remember one of my earliest memories is my dad singing in the car. He would sing a melody line, like, la, 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 la. And then I would sing it back to him. And so we did this, like, call and response game.
Awesome.
So I think that's where my ear came from. But then I didn't really sing. I really, really focused on the violin for, I mean, a long time, until I was in my 20s. So I just played and played and played. And did classical all the way through high school. And then after high school, I realized I wasn't going to major in music. I did political science and psychology. So I wanted to do something different. So that's when I got into Celtic music.
I was going to ask you, like, okay, so you were classically trained, but then things went in an obviously different direction for you musically. I should ask you who your favorite classical composers are before we...
I really like Bach and Tchaikovsky. I mean, those are the ones that when we would play, because we had a really, really good orchestra conductor, and I had an amazing private lesson teacher. He was like the conductor at the college in my town, and he was great. And so, and then I played Beethoven's Romance in F, I believe, for my senior solo, and he helped me to like really polish it. So Beethoven's cool too, but it was really Tchaikovsky and Bach are my two favorites.
So you get out of high school, and you go to college, and you study something not related to music. And did you move away from music for a bit, or did you keep playing just in a more casual way?
Well, the first year of college, I don't think I played anything, which was weird. Like, well, no, that's not totally true. I guess there was, like, the first semester I did orchestra at college, and I really didn't like it. Like, it wasn't the same. You know, in orchestra in high school, all my best friends were in it, and it was, there's a lot going on that kept me there, and the orchestra at the college I was at it just wasn't the same feeling, and I didn't know people in there, and it was a lot of practice for one credit, you know, I mean, like, yeah. I wasn't a music major, I didn't need to take it, so I dropped out of orchestra, and there was about, maybe not a whole year, but maybe like 9 months, mm-hmm. where I would maybe play at an open mic in my hometown when I went home, or, you know, like, jam once in a while, but I really wasn't playing. And that's when somebody told me about a group called Flying Fingers, mm-hmm. which was a Celtic group. And what it was is sponsored by the college. And all these people would get together. There'd be about 50 of us. And we'd break into bands of five or six for the semester. And once a week, our band would, like, set up a practice and we'd meet. It was so low-key and a really, really, really fun way to stay connected with music, but it wasn't a high-pressure situation.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot of Celtic fiddle tunes there. I also went home, you know, when I was home, I would do the Celtic jam mm-hmm. at our tavern, but that's, like, kind of what music was for me at that point.
Yeah.
But I liked it a lot. It just wasn't something I thought, like, would take over my existence. You know what I mean? But I'm grateful that I found that fiddle group, because honestly, I think back and I'm not sure if I would have kept up the violin. I mean, I hope that I would have, but mm-hmm. it gave me a reason to keep playing that was important.
What? And this is going to sound like a dumb question, but what is, okay, you use the term fiddle.
Oh, yeah.
How is that different than more traditional violin playing?
It's more just like stylistic. It's the same instrument now. I think maybe back in the day, there might have been slight differences between like a classical violin. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I've heard different things on that.
Yeah.
I know for sure, though, that the style is different. I kind of blend the two. Traditional music doesn't usually have vibrato, which is the way the note sounds really luscious.
Mm-hmm.
Where you kind of move your finger around and it changes, you know.
Yeah.
And really traditional music, people don't hold the bow in the same exact way. But I don't hold mine in a regular way anyways.
Yeah.
So I kind of just decided that I would play what I liked the way it sounded. And so I don't play the straight up traditional fiddle method. I kind of blend classical and fiddle.
Do you think that like your particular style of holding the bow and having the instrument made it easier for you to kind of make that transition from classical music to a different style of music? Like you're already accustomed to playing in a different way than I know classical music violinists, and just you know, I know that the way that they hold their bow, the way that they hold the instrument is key to the sound.
Yeah.
At least in their minds, like that, it's key to making that particular sound. So I'm wondering if like you're already using the instrument physically in a different way, maybe like put you in a kind of ahead of the game and being able to like transition to a different style.
I don't know, because in some ways playing it upright actually makes fiddle music harder. I don't use, and the other thing about my style, which I don't talk about a whole lot because it's not super relevant now, the way because I write my own music a lot mm-hmm. of times, or make my own arrangements, but I don't use my fourth finger the way my hand is angled. I can't use my pinky, and a lot of fiddlers use it all the time.
Yeah.
And so fiddle music straight, like if I was going to go up against like a bluegrass fiddler, they can play faster than me, usually. Mm-hmm. I can play that fast, but it takes a lot of practice because my bow is moving around more because I'm switching strings more often. It's kind of technical, but that being said, I do think thinking outside the box has maybe been easier mm-hmm. for me. You know, like, I guess I just feel like I want what I play to sound like something that I enjoy. Mm-hmm. And I've never been super uptight about, like, you know, I guess maybe the biggest difference in classical music, for example, I played the same music as all my peers, but I would have to shift on the fingerboard more because I didn't use my pinky finger, mm-hmm. and then also my bow is a half-size bow, mm-hmm. so I had to take extra bows all the time, and so I was already kind of used to just being like, well, whatever works, you know. I would try to keep in line with the bows in general, but there would be extra bows in there if you watch really close. Like, I can't do the same length. I just have a shorter bow, and so I guess I was used to just kind of adapting what to make it as close, you know. Yeah. I don't know. But the fiddle music, the biggest challenge, I think, for a lot of classical people is the idea of learning by ear. And luckily, I learned how to play by ear in a really low key setting, you know, that fiddle group, and then at the Celtic jams. And it wasn't like I was performing right away doing that. I was kind of just messing around. And so it gave me the freedom to learn by ear. And I think a lot of people are afraid of playing by ear. But once you get used to it, it's so useful. Like, I still read music. I taught fiddle for 3 years to other students, and I taught them to play on their shoulder like the regular way. Because fiddle music is, again, you can kind of break some rules. So I felt comfortable teaching that so that I would explain it, and they would just, you know, I would show them pictures and stuff.
Yeah.
Of like, you're supposed to hold it like this, and here's a photo of what you're doing. But, yeah, but classical, I think it is, you know, once you have the foundation of reading music and then you learn how to improvise, the whole world is yours. Like, being able to do both, I think, is like, I wish more people could experience that, because it's really neat. Like, you have so much freedom.
Freedom,
and then, but you still have the ability to, like, go to the written music. And if you really want to learn a piece that's too hard to learn by ear, you can do it a different way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's fun to be able to do both. So I want my students and, you know, I encourage people to do both, you know.
Yeah. We should pause for a minute and talk about brittle bones disease, which is something we've kind of alluded to the fact
that
you deal with some physical challenges in, in playing your instrument. Can you talk about what brittle bones disease is?
Yeah, it's the medical name or whatever is osteogenesis imperfecta. And what it is the collagen in my bones and all over my body, actually. Collagen's pretty much everywhere in all your tissues. It has a genetic mutation. Like, it's not the same. And I don't actually know what type of OI I have. There's different ways that the gene can be mutated. And so, and it kind of comes out in different ways. But my bones are very light and not super dense.
Yeah.
So on an x-ray, they look kind of airy and almost bubbly instead of solid. So that being said, before I was born, I broke maybe 30 or 40 bones in utero. I mean, I don't remember it, obviously.
Yeah.
and they don't hurt anymore, but they did heal crooked. And so, because my back when ultrasounds were just like blobs, they didn't know I had the disability. So my mom went to full term and all this stuff. And so a lot of my bones broke and had already healed wrong by the time I was born. Yeah, so my legs and arms are short, and so I'm really small in stature. And I could have had a surgery, one on each arm, so it would have been four.
Yeah.
One on each arm and leg. It would have been four total surgeries to fix my limbs, where they would break the bone again and then put a rod in there. And a lot of people get it, but my parents decided to let me choose. And I'm glad that they did, because by the time I was approaching like the age where you kind of have to know, I had already started playing violin. And to do such a major surgery to straighten a limb that's been bent your whole life, you can lose nerve function.
Oh, wow.
And it's not a guarantee that you will, but it's a sign that it can happen.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, wheelchairs are getting better and better. Like, I'm just going to stay the way I am because I really liked playing. And I'm really glad that that was an option I had to choose.
So I wouldn't, like, that's interesting that your ability to play music literally informed your decision about having a surgery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
wow, that says something about your dedication to your music.
Well, yeah, and it wasn't like a, I mean, it's funny because music is obviously very, very important to me, but I never felt it. It just was a thing that I enjoyed. It wasn't like, well, if I don't do this, my destiny will be different. But then it turns out, I look back and I'm like, whoa, that was a really important decision. And I just was like, violin is fun. I'm going to keep doing it. You know, it wasn't like a thing.
Yeah.
But obviously, it is. You know what I mean? It was a really important thing to me on some kind of subconscious level, at least. Because, yeah, that's why I didn't get the surgery. And so I've never walked. And my arms and legs have always been bent. And so I use an electric wheelchair. And the reason, because my arms and legs are bent, that's why the violin was just too big.
Yeah.
And the cello was too big because they're much shorter.
Yeah, I can see a cello being too big.
Yeah, it would have been cool. I've seen since then, like, the babiest cello is basically an oversized viola. And I've played one of those and I've pondered, but it doesn't sound the same. I mean, a cello, part of what's beautiful about a cello is how big and cavernous they are.
Right.
Yeah. And it's a little different on a baby cello. Yeah. So, yeah.
How many people deal with brittle bones disease?
It's a, considered a rare disease, so it's like 1 in 50,000, I think.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
I'm pretty sure that's the right number. You might want to fact check that one. But yeah. I think it's 1 in 50,000. But it really varies. Like, there's, I think, at least... I mean, they keep finding new mutations. When I was born, they thought there were 4 types, and now there's more than 8. So it's a disease that they're learning more and more about. And some people are more severe. Like, even though mine is considered pretty significant because I broke a lot in utero, since I was born, I've only broken 16, which still is a lot for someone who doesn't have my, my disability.
I've never broken one, so I feel like that's a lot.
It is a lot, but for someone with my disability, it's actually not. Some people can break a lot more than that. And some people with my disability can walk if they haven't. You know, if they didn't have problems in utero, they can still walk. They just break bones more often. So it really varies the way it looks in people. So,
wow.
Yeah, that's kind of a long medical explanation.
No, that's, like, that's
this
really
is the medical podcast.
Yes, we're learning about science and music today.
Yes.
So, I'm wondering, have you ever experienced a feeling of man, like, why is my life so difficult? I can't, like, I wish I could play this instrument as a typical person would, or, you know?
No, I mean, no, not in that way. I mean, the things that have been difficult are primarily, like, having equal access to employment or buildings, you know what I mean? Like, those kind of things are stressful, but I really, really, for a long time, have felt that without my disability, I would not be the same person. Like, it's really, it's a part of who I am, and I don't know. And same with music. You know, back in my classical days, classical music is pretty competitive, and back then, I wasn't blaming it on my disability or anything, but it's a very competitive field, and I'm kind of a perfectionist, and I remember just being like, the shifting around made it harder, but it didn't make me sad. It was just like, I had to do more practicing. But I liked practicing. So I don't know. You know, music and disability has never been like a negative correlation for me.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, speaking of music, we should get back to that. And I want to jump in where you met Alan Sparhawk and you guys started collaborating, because I know that that had a major... impact on your career, and your music. Was your music, but prior to meeting Alan, were you pursuing it as a career? Or were you continuing to just like kind of do it for fun?
As a career, no. So I started out in like when I got back to Duluth, I moved back. I went to college in St. Paul, moved back to Duluth, and graduated in Duluth. Actually, I had started playing in a folk duo with a guy named Andy Gable, and he was really fun. And then at the time when I met Alan Sparhawk, I was playing in a folk duo with a girl named Ariane Norgard. And so I was playing, like, Andy had moved to Wyoming, and I started a new band. And I was playing quite a bit, but it was sort of just like this thing I did.
Yeah.
You know, I was working and playing, and it was fun. And even when I met Alan, that was the case for quite a while. Yeah, he really, like, changed the trajectory musically for me. Like, he's the first person that introduced me to a looping pedal. Mm-hmm. And that was really cool. We met because I was jamming with a guy named Charlie Parr at a farmer's market. And Alan had walked by, but I didn't really listen to Lowe.
Yeah.
And so I didn't recognize him. I didn't know he was there. And then a couple weeks later, got a message, like, do you want to do a project together? And I was like, yeah, that'd be awesome. So we did, and he brought out the looping pedal, and he was looping me, and I would play it, because I like improvising. I would play like harmonies to the loops, and so I'd play on top of myself, but I wasn't the one looping. And then maybe about a year and a half in, he came over for a band practice, and he's like, here's this looping pedal, I want you to have it, like, I think you should learn how to use it. And someday you'll do shows by yourself. And I was laughing in my head because I was like, no way, I'm never doing that. But he was right. I mean, it was really fun. And then the other, and eventually that's what ended up happening. I mean, we still play together whenever we can. But the other big thing is songwriting. Like, I had never written my own song. Mm-hmm. I sang covers and I was in bands with people who wrote their own songs, and like I hadn't done that yet. And I think maybe just like the whole world opening up with a looping pedal and just like seeing music in a different way. One day I just like had an idea for a song and I wrote it down, and the next day Alan and I actually had a band practice, and I was like, hey, this is kind of weird, but I wrote a song. Do you want to hear it? I've never written a song before. And he's like, sure. So I played it for him. And he's like, that's good. Let's do it tomorrow at our show. And I was like, oh, my gosh. So I did. And that was kind of like the entrance into songwriting.
Nice.
I'm not the most prolific. I think I've done like maybe a dozen of them. But I'm having more ideas now than I was before. So I think it's starting to be something that I can develop. And I love it. Like when it happens, it's like, so exciting, you know.
Yeah.
Writing a song is a very energizing thing.
I should explain for listeners who don't know who Alan Sparhawk or Lowe is, that Lowe is an indie band from Duluth that's been around for a really long time. They're decades. They're known for the kind of music called slowcore that they kind of, I think they kind of helped that come about.
Invented it.
Yeah,
totally. I mean, I don't know, but it seems like it, yeah.
Very meditative and sort of has this like kind of spiritual quality to it. Their music lately, which I'm a huge fan of, they've picked up the pace just a little bit. Which, you know, if you've never heard them, you'll laugh if you hear their current music.
Yeah, it's not actually fast.
Yeah, it's not fast. Yeah, but it's a little more cheery, a little less somber. Perhaps that's indicative of things that have gone on in their lives. I don't know, but they're. They're kind of a big deal in that particular world of music. People look up to them at this point, I think.
Yeah.
It's really funny to me that he was there and you're like, who's this guy?
I didn't even know he was there. Yeah. I actually didn't know he was there. Yeah. And I was like, why is he contacting me? And then he told me that he had been. We did a silent film, so that was our first thing.
Oh, cool.
So he had a project, like an assignment to do a live score to a silent film, and he asked if I would do that. And it's a two-hour film, so you know, or an hour and a half or something. So we had a lot of practices for that, like maybe eight, and we would go through the movie and pick out themes and like create this soundtrack for this film. And then at the last rehearsal before the show, he's like, well, this has been fun. We should probably book some shows. So then we decided to form a band after that. So I wasn't really sure.
And that's
really
Murder of Crows.
Yep, the Murder of Crows.
The Murder of Crows.
I think there's like a heavy metal band called Murder of Crows. So if you look that up, you will be like, ooh, this is the wrong band. We are not heavy metal. Yes.
Decidedly not.
Nope. Yeah. But it was really fun. I'm sure we'll do stuff down the line. It's funny, like we've both gotten busier and I'm not really home right now and stuff, but whenever we get to play together, it's really special to me. I mean, we are not the same and our music isn't actually the same, but something really cool. I don't know, the combination is really, really cool to me. So
I love that about collaboration.
Yeah.
How it just like the creative stuff in each person like makes something totally different than you might make alone or with any other combination of people. I want to talk about the looping pedal, and I think it's so interesting. I've seen several artists perform with the looping pedal, and I find it just fascinating because in addition to playing the instrument, you're keeping track of the effects on this pedal. And then you're keeping track of the loop that's playing or the multiple loops that are playing. It's kind of mind-blowing to watch somebody play with a looping pedal. Can you talk about how it works and also kind of how it's changed your playing and like your...
Oh, yeah. Well, how it works on my particular pedal, every pedal is a little different, is I hold it down and I have to hold it the whole time I'm playing, which I don't think is actually that common. I think usually you press it once and it starts recording. But mine, I hold down the whole time I'm playing, and then the second I let go, the repeat starts. So the timing of that, it was really, really difficult at the beginning for me to get. And still, once in a while, you're like, well, that was not the right time, and you got to restart. Because the thing about the loop is once it's set, that is it. And so you have to have the timing right. And the way I started looping, to the advice of Alan, which I thought was really cool, is the more ambient, like long, slow notes that kind of can collide with other chords, and it doesn't have to be like a perfect fit. That's a really good way to start looping and keep looping if that's like your style, for sure. I, because of my classical background, I think, I started experimenting more, not so much in the Murder of Crows, but in my own solo stuff, with a little bit more rhythmic, not so rhythmic that it's like techno sounding or anything, but I really liked the fact that fiddle tunes especially are repetitive. They have like an A and a B, an A and a B, and if you get the bass line right and then you add another layer, by the end you can add like a few different harmonies, and all of a sudden you have something like a traditional song but done like super different, like an orchestral arrangement. And that's really fun for me. That's what I got really excited about. And then I figured that you could also do that with the songs that you write. And so then I started singing over the top of that, and that kind of
awesome.
It's been really fun. But it changes the way you think, because you do think about what will fit here. And like there are some songs that I actually can't play without like the Murder of Crows or another guitar player, because if they change keys in the middle or they have like a different chord progression, there's, you know, some things that you can't do on a looping pedal, at least me yet. I mean, there's so much out there though. And that's the other inspiring thing about looping and effects and things that I would never have thought to add, which is why I'm so grateful for having gotten to know Alan, is that like it's infinite. I mean, you can do so much, and there's always room to grow and learn, and like I can't imagine ever getting bored with that kind of stuff.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Can you, before we started recording, you were talking about how it's a little bit annoying that people think that someone else is pushing a button for you somewhere, or that it's pre-recorded or something like that. But it's actually like, this is part of your performance. This is you making this happen. I'm wondering if you could just do a demonstration to kind of like illustrate
how
it works.
Well, and I feel bad. You know? It's not annoying. I guess I didn't mean it that way.
That was my interpretation.
Oh, okay. Yes.
No, I would be annoyed.
It's just kind of funny, because to me, the beauty of live looping, as opposed to any other kind of looping, because there are looping pedals that you can pre-record tracks. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's totally fine. Like, I know that people do that.
Right.
But what
it's
inspires...
It's not like cheating.
No, I don't think it's cheating, because you can do different things that I probably can't do if you do that. You know what I mean? Like, I think everybody has a reason for what they do on the pedals. But what I think is really beautiful, and that's another thing playing in the Murder of Crows like helped you to see, is it's really ephemeral. It's like, this is this loop, and when I turn this button off, it's going to be gone, and I will never hear it again in this particular way. And, like, that's something that's really cool to me. And I don't know if it really matters that the audience understand that, but when they do understand what looping is, it makes the show even more fun, I think, because they realize that what they're hearing is, like, the only version that will be exactly like that.
And that
it's all done live, and it's sort of like walking on a tightrope for me, like, sometimes you can get away with an imperfect loop as long as you can understand where you're going to need to adjust and stuff. So it's never boring, that's for sure. And I think that's part of what makes it fun for me. And whether or not the audience understands, I suppose, doesn't matter. But it is, it adds like a layer of like complexity that I think is really fun.
Yeah.
The live aspect of it, you know?
Well, yeah, and like you touched on something really interesting there, which is like part of what makes going to a live performance so interesting is that it's live. It's not going to exist in that exact form anywhere else.
Yeah.
And the music is more, it's more personal. You pay more attention to it, you know, for that reason, because it's, as you said, ephemeral.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, on the first album that I recorded, All the Roads But Lead Us Home, it's mostly instrumental. That, all the tracks, because you can't really do much mm-hmm. with a recording
yeah.
that's live looped. Like, you can't cut it up or, like, slide in a thing here. Uh-huh. So all of those songs are one take, too, mm-hmm. and I sing. So, like, even that is, like, it's a studio recording because it was mixed and mastered,
yeah.
but it's actually a live.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I might have done a few takes of each song and took the one that fit the best, you know, mm-hmm. that I liked the best. But it's fun. I think live looping, I don't know. I think it's a really fun art form. I don't know. I like it.
Well,
but I can demonstrate.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love it if you would.
So basically what I'm doing is you push a button down and you start the first track. And that usually ends up being some kind of bass
okay.
note. So it'd be... And then you let go. And it's playing it back. And then whenever you want, you can add more, so.
So cool.
Yeah, thanks. So
that was awesome.
So you don't always have to record everything.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll choose to record a certain line, and then the next few lines I won't be recording, because yeah. then it keeps the... Because that was only 4 notes, right, to yeah. start with. So you don't want to go too fast, or by the end of the song there's like 8,000 yeah. notes playing. You know what I mean?
Right.
So you kind of choose when to loop and when to let it just be a melody line, and uh-huh. it's really fun. Everybody does it different, and that's another thing is, like, for what looping is, it's crazy to me how much variety there is mm-hmm. in the way you can do it. Alan loops way differently than I do, although we have, like, some similarities.
Yeah.
We don't actually do it in the same way most yeah. of the time. It's fun, though. I mean, like...
It's cool. It opens up, like, a whole new world of...
Oh, gosh,
of audio.
I remember the night that he gave me the pedal and I hadn't touched it yet. And then there was one night where I had some time, so I decided to practice. And I remember creating basically something sort of like that, like a small little segment. Mm. But I had never really done it. And I got so excited. And I remember, like, recording it and, like, texting it to him at, like, 1 a.m. and being like, oh, my gosh, like, you can do this. And it's, like, he obviously knew that. But I like, had not really realized yeah. what the possibilities were. And it was, like, a whole new... It's like stepping into another universe. It was so cool. That's like, cool. Yeah, I'm very, very, very grateful for that. Yeah.
Part of the reason that a lot of our listeners may be familiar with your name is that you won the second ever Tiny Desk Contest, NPR's 2016 Tiny Desk Contest, with your song Someday We'll Linger in the Sun.
Yes.
Which is just a haunting, amazing melody. It's like once you hear it, you can't unhear it.
Oh.
And talk to me about why you entered the contest and then, like, kind of how that changed your career,
or yeah.
changed your life.
Well, I entered because 2 fiddle students separately emailed me a link, and they're like, oh my gosh, you should totally enter this. And then a good friend also separately sent me a link and was like, really think you should enter this. So I had heard of the Tiny Desk concerts, but yeah. I had not heard of the contest. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe, you know, that'd be kind of fun, I guess. And so... the more I thought about it, I was like, yeah, I do want to try. I mean, but 0% chance thinking you would win, right? So, but I did. I found out that friend that sent me the link. I was like, well, will you come up to my lesson space and record? So about a week before I recorded the video, I played a gig at a pizza shop, and I had the audience vote on 3 songs. I played 3 because I was kind of torn about which one to enter. Mm-hmm. And it was like very strongly in favor of Someday Will Linger in the Sun. So I was like, okay, well, that's the one I'll do. And then I got with her and we recorded it up in my studio. I think we took 3 takes and it was on my phone camera. Very, very lo-fi. But I entered it and never heard anything for like a month. And but like people were watching it on YouTube and I was getting like, I was surprised by the responses because I was like, whoa, okay, like, people seem to connect with it, but I hadn't expected that.
Our rope's a complex vintage wine, all rotted leaves and lemon rind. I spit you out, but now you're mine. We bit.
And then, yeah, about the end of February of last year, so a little over a year ago, I got an email from NPR right in between my lessons, and they're like, can we talk to you preferably today? And I thought maybe I was a finalist, which was really exciting, and I started, like, shaking and, like, holy crap. And then I had to teach a lesson, which was really weird. But luckily, the student that I was teaching was one of the ones that told me about the contest, so I could share with her, like, oh, my gosh, they want to talk. And it was a fun day. And then at the end of the day when they finally did call, it was Bob Boylan on the other end of the line. And he was like talking about other, I mean, he had clearly listened to some of the other music I had put out there, like my solo album. He had heard it, and we were talking, and then at the end of the conversation he said, we want to make you the winner of the contest. And I was like, what? It was so surreal. It was very weird. But they were so sweet. And then we went on a 5-city tour with them like that spring, and they're just like the most wonderful people. I mean, I have a lot of respect. I mean, I had a feeling they'd be cool, but, like, they're this actually just so nice. But NPR staff.
The All Songs Considered. Yep, is it primarily that group
that
of
crew,
people?
Yep. Okay. But then there was somebody from, like, you know, marketing. And, like, you know, different
so
people went
crew.
Along. But it was kind of this core group of, like, 5 different people that I got to know pretty well. And they are just, like, so sweet. And they really, 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 really care about making sure they do it the right way, which meant a lot to me. Like, a couple of the judges didn't actually see my video the first time they heard it. They were just putting it on a playlist. So they weren't picking it based on, like, disability or even the fact that I knew Alan, because they don't, they make a point of not researching people until they pick a winner.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so they had, when they were researching it for, to, like, decide if that was going to be the person they won, that's when they found out I knew Alan and that we played together. And that's why he joined me on my tiny desk. They're like, we love Alan. Will he come with you? And I was like, probably, sure. So it was a really fun time. It's changed a lot of things.
Yeah, I imagine. Like, that's, I mean, your name definitely got more widespread. And but how has that, what's the short story of how you got to where you are now and what you're doing now and the contests, like, what's been the trajectory?
Yeah, well, after the contest, I started getting requests to play farther and farther away and do some really cool things that I wouldn't probably have had a chance to do. And a booking agent approached me, like, but he was a really sweet, he's a good person, like, I really, really like him.
Yeah.
And he... And I started thinking about it because it was getting kind of overwhelming. Like, I was teaching and still and, like, performing more than I had ever performed. And then thinking about traveling, it was just, like, too much. So we started working together back in May, and he kind of got everything in place to start touring at the end of September. So he created this tour. And my husband, I need a travel companion. Like, I can't travel by myself. I don't drive. I need, like, assistance and stuff. And so we told the booking agent, like, if we're going to do this, it has to be full time because my husband's going to have to take a leave of absence from work. Mm-hmm. And, like, he won't be able to work because we're going to have to do this together. So he booked like a really vigorous tour. We've between October 1st and May 1st, I think we'll have done 150 shows.
Holy moly.
Yeah, like very vigorous.
That's
tour.
Crazy. Yeah, you're not kidding.
I mean, no, I'm not kidding. And we went all over the country, and I got to open for Low in Ireland, which was really special. That was in December. That was a really cool. I'm so glad that worked out. And so, yeah, just a lot of traveling that I had never thought about doing. We sold our house and got a different van to, like, make it kind of financially feasible.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, man. It's been fun, but it's, like, everything is so different now. I'm not teaching right now. Someday, yeah. I'm sure I'll teach again, but it was just too much going on. But it's
wow.
cool. Yeah, it's been
That's
really
awesome.
Fun. Yeah.
It sounds like you're mid-adventure right now.
Yep. Yep, That's basically. Cool. We're heading out to California next, and we're still gone for like a whole another month and a week or something, so 5 more weeks, and then we'll go home for a little bit.
Yeah.
So it'll be good.
Well, Galen Lee, thank you so much for taking time out of your crazy busy schedule to come and talk to me.
Thank you so much,
today.
Yeah.
You've
thank
been
you.
Really generous with your time. I appreciate
Aww,
it.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. Follow the social media links there. Email me at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Rate us, review us, shout about us to the rooftops. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Turnt Up Hulslander. Thanks to Mark DiClaudio for his piercing loop pedal eyes. Thanks to Galen Lee for being so generous today. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.